Translation: are all the chieftain sons of Lord Krishna, such as Sushena, Charudeshna, Samba, the son of Jambavati, and Rishabha, along with their sons, all doing well? Purport given by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada Ki. As already mentioned, Lord Krishna married 16,108 wives, and each of them had 10 sons. Therefore, 16,108 times 10 equals 161,080 sons. They all grew up, and each of them had as many sons as their father, and the whole aggregate was something near 1,610,800 family members of the Lord. The Lord is the father of all living beings, who are countless in number. Therefore, only a few of them are called to associate with the Lord in his transcendental pastimes as the Lord of Dwarka on this earth. It is not astonishing that the Lord maintained a visible family consisting of so many members. It is better to refrain from comparing the Lord's position to ours, and it becomes a simple truth as soon as we understand at least a partial calculation of the Lord's transcendental position. King Yudhishthir, while inquiring about the Lord's sons and grandsons at Dwarka, mentioned only the chieftains amongst them, for it is impossible for him to remember all the names of the Lord's family members. So that's text 31. Sushenas Charudeshnascha Sambo Jambavati Sutaha Anyacha Karshni Pravaraha Saputra Rishabhadaya. Are all the chieftain sons of Lord Krishna, such as Sushena, Charudeshna, Samba, the son of Jambavati, and Rishabha, along with their sons, all doing well? Okay, so Hare Krishna, everyone. If I can ask for everyone's blessings on this verse. Actually, first, I just want to say we have some good news. I'm sure it was announced in the morning today. His Holiness Bhakti Chaur Maharaj, his situation is getting much better now. So I'm sure all of us at the manor are praying for his swift recovery. So I'm sure, obviously, our congregation members will be pleased to know that as well. He's a great saint in our movement. I'd like to get the blessings of all the saints here as well and those who are watching online. So this is... for me, it's a rather tough verse, I must say, because it's bringing out certain points which frankly, are very hard to decipher or understand with our mental calculation. And so therefore, what we're going to do, we're going to try and make it interactive today so we can work through it together. We're going to work through these issues together, okay? So one of the first things that comes out from this verse is the, which is something that obviously we see throughout the Bhagavatam and the CC, well, all the scriptures actually, is the stupendous numbers involved. Like, you know, if you look about the human capacity in terms of human magnitude, it just, you know, it beggars belief, as they say, right? Like, for example, Krishna, he had 1,610,800 family members. Okay. So how does actually one understand this? How was he maintaining them, right? Of course, one can say that in Krishna's sake, in Krishna's example, that obviously he is the Lord, so therefore he is omnipotent, right? So therefore he can expand himself and he can maintain them very nicely. And we know we obviously mentioned a few weeks back in a session how Narad Muni would go to each of the palaces and see Krishna nicely having his interactions with his family members in all the different palaces. But nonetheless, it's something, I guess, especially people who are coming from outside us to read this, how would they understand such things? How could we convey this understanding to people? There's also other aspects like this that we see in the scriptures. For example, I was talking to Suthapa Prabhu the other day. Other examples could be like King Chetraketu. Right, you know, King Chitraketu in the sixth canto, he had 10 million wives, right? How does one understand that? He's obviously not God, right? Obviously, I'm sure he's a very highly empowered being. And granted, he's living in a previous age where, you know, the kind of material parameters are maybe slightly different then. But how does one understand? How do you maintain 10 million wives. You know, it's like, you know, I think for a lot of people, just maintaining one wife will be like quite a task in this day and age, right? So he's maintaining 10 million wives. Then, of course, we've got the other classic example from Krishna book, which is Maharaj Ugrasen, right? Doesn't even know how many bodyguards he had. Yes, how much was it? 14 trillion, yeah? Quadrillion, right. So he had a quadrillion bodyguards. I'm not even sure how many zeros that is after a one, like quadrillion. I can go up to, I know a trillion is like 12 zeros. Then after that, I'm not sure where the quadrillion is. So again, how does one understand that? How does one have quadrillion bodyguards, right? Once these disciples were talking to these non-devotees about the scriptures, and some of them were reading a few aspects, and they were asking, so how do they all live there? Like, how do they, like, and obviously they were like mundane people, right? So they were kind of like having a bit of a fun with it. And this thing, how do they all fit into Dwarka? And like, what about the toilet facilities and stuff like that? It's like their bodily maintenance. It's like, you know, because they're looking at complete from a material perspective. But again, it does raise a question. How does one understand this? In the CC as well, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we have the, you know, the kirtan, the famous, there's the Bera kirtan, the, you know, the big one where, you know, there's descriptions verse after verse of like a sea of devotees that are, you know, never ending and like towards the horizon. It's like, you know, like in like a village setting, you know, like in Navadvip. It's like, where did all these people suddenly come from? You know, it's like, you know, innumerable entities taking part in the kirtan. So that's the question. That's our first question for today. How does one understand these stupendous figures? Any thoughts on that, Prabhus and Matajis? Yes, Srinivas Prabhu.
The thing is, unless you accept the omnipotency of the Lord, it's hard to accept what Krishna does. So Jiva Goswami says you have to accept the omnipotency of the Lord. Then you can understand these figures.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, we have to obviously understand, obviously, Krishna is inconceivable in his potencies. Any other thoughts? Any other thoughts on this? It's a tough one, isn't it? Yes, Sutapa?
I mean, not specifically on this, but just in terms of perception and understanding of reality. Like, we often give the example that if you told someone 100 years ago that you could, like, pick up a plastic thing like this, push a button, and speak to someone on the other side of the world, they'd probably think you're talking about something from, like, a fantasy book or something, like. But now we do it without even thinking about it. So that's just in the space of 100 years, in the same planet, you know, in the same culture, that, you know, things become inconceivable when there's a gap of time. So I think when you're dealing with the Bhagavatam, which is, you know, a whole different, you know, civilization from a whole different time, then we have to understand the limits of perception in grasping that reality and the biases that we hold.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's you know, kind of like the point that we were also looking at, is that, you know, the human mind, you know, we only really actually tend to work within our limited parameters of what we're used to. And otherwise it's very hard for us to conceive of things beyond that remit. One thing that His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhu was saying is that also that, especially in this age, we tend to look at things in terms of what is empirically measurable. Empirical means that what we can measure with our particular senses. But there, you know, there is things to consider that is, goes beyond our senses as well, which we may not see right now in the physical dimension. Even for example, entities as well. We also tend to look at a number of entities in terms of, are they empirically measurable, right? But then, you know, one has to be open to the fact that a lot of these entities could be on subtle, because Prabhupada talks about the fact that there are subtle dimensions, right? There are subtle dimensions within this world. It's not just us human beings here. Even within this space, there are probably other beings. We know even amongst devotees have had experiences, encounters, where, you know, they've... with the other dimensions, shall we say. There's a wonderful book called Alien Identities by Sadaputta Prabhu, who Richard L. Thompson. He talks about it, but it was not like just based on, like, you know, conspiracy theories and stuff. He uses a lot of case studies and facts and things like that. So there's a lot going on in this world beyond what we actually see before us. So that's one of the aspects to remember. And actually, there's actually an example in the Mahabharata when... Well, actually, there's many examples of this in Mahabharata, to be honest. But this one time when Yudhishthira Maharaj, he was doing the Rajasuya Yajna after establishing Indraprastha as his kingdom. And it said that at that time, he sent his brothers to conquer the different parts of the world. So Bhim went east, Sahadev went south, Nakul went east, and Arjun went north. Right, and actually, it said that they were not just conquering physical lands; they were also conquering subtle realms as well. So, for example, Sahadev, this is a very, very famous pastime from the Mahabharata. He actually ended up having a battle with Lord Agni himself, the fire demigod, to actually, you know, take over a certain realm called Mahishmati, which is under Agni's protection because Agni had married the daughter of the king of Mahishmati. So he said that I'm going to protect your kingdom. Sahadev had had a war with him. When Arjun was going up north to the Himalayan kingdoms, it said that he'd actually even also in the Himalayan regions, he'd go into portholes, and from the portholes, he would then go into upper, you know, regions to actually conquer celestial lands as well. And in fact, Prabhupada has mentioned that there are certain areas in the world where there are portholes which can go into other dimensions of reality. So then who's to say that then there are also people in those other dimensions that are also giving their protection to us and also taking part in our affairs, worldly affairs, which we may not know about. Interestingly, actually, we mentioned Bhakti Charamaj at the beginning. He also mentioned the same thing as well. Even now, there are portholes in certain regions of the world which access to other regions. So we have to be open to this understanding. And we actually even see at one point... Duryodhan, when the Pandavas were in the 13th year of the exile, Duryodhan went with his army to try and defeat the Pandavas in the forest, but instead they got captured by the Gandharvas. The Pandavas came, rescued Duryodhan from the Gandharvas. Duryodhan felt very humiliated. He then, out of sense of dishonor, he was about to take his own life. And then, from another otherworldly region, the nether regions, Danavas started appearing. Danavas are like type of demonic beings. And they said to Duryodhan, don't worry, we're here for you. There's going to be big war and we're going to be on your side. And even though we're not physically, might not be there with you in our physical forms, but we're there with you on a subtle region, giving you strength, giving you power. So who's to say then also that in a lot of the wars and stuff, there are also subtle beings that are taking part in these wars. Then you look at, obviously, Ugrasen had his bodyguards. So we have to define, are they bodyguards just in physical forms, in the way we know now? Are they also protecting them on different levels of existence as well? And then obviously, if you try to actually just look at things from a higher material dimension, then you can see that, okay, there's lots more going on in this world than what we see before us. Again, Prabhupada, I remember it was Kishori Mataji, she was asking a question about how Narada Muni would sometimes appear in Prabhupada's, programs and stuff. But Prabhupada could see him because Prabhupada had the higher vision of seeing things on a subtle level and a gross level, but the other devotees couldn't see that. So who's to say there are many more devotees here amongst us than, you know, we might actually see. So anyway, this is one of the first aspects that comes from this verse, is the stupendous numbers. However, there is one thing. When the disciples were talking to these scientific people about these figures, they said to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, they're mocking us. They're actually saying that, oh, why are you talking about these, they made that joke in about, oh, Ugrasena's gods, how do they live there? How do the maintenance is being made? You know, they're doing it in a kind of derisive way. So in one sense, Prabhupada could easily have, you know, given like some answer to kind of like, solve that issue. Actually, he said to them that, is that the only thing you can focus on? When you're preaching to this group of people, is that the only thing you can focus on? Why did you go directly for that? So the whole point is that obviously when we're giving, understanding of Bhagavatam and CC and things like that, obviously amongst devotees, we can try to make sense of these issues. But obviously when we're conveying this this kind of knowledge to other people, our main goal is to obviously give the essence of what the Krishna consciousness philosophy is about. We don't necessarily need to go into these inconceivable things just yet. First, let them understand the basics, right? Because that's the more important thing. That's why Prabhupada say our focus is on Krishna, his qualities, relationship with the devotees, not so much of the technical details. That will come later. Technical details come later. First, get the mood, get the understanding of what Krishna has with his devotees, the relationship. That's the main thing. That's why we have the ninth offense, isn't it? To instruct a faithless person about the glories of the holy name. So that means when you're meeting new people who do not have faith, you can tell them about the fact that you're not the body, the soul, there's karma, reincarnation, meditation, but you're not going to go into the deeper kind of like inconceivable esoteric aspects just yet. Let them develop some faith first, right? Because otherwise then the fault's on our side. Okay, so that's one aspect. Thank you for participating in that. There'll be more questions to come, of course. So the next aspect here is, Prabhupada is saying here that ultimately Krishna is the father of all living beings who are countless in number. Yeah. So he's a seed-giving father. We know the verse from Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Yonishu Kanteya Murtaya Sambhavantiya Tasam Brahma Mahad Yonir Aham Bija Pradapita. Right? O son of Kunti, I have to paraphrase a little bit. O son of Kunti, of all the species of life, I am the seed-giving father. Right? The famous verse. So, it should be understood that obviously he is the father of everyone. Okay? And we know that. And one thing that Prabhupada is saying here is there's no point comparing ourselves to him. It's saying here, it is better to refrain from comparing the Lord's position to ours. Right? And then it becomes a simple truth. Okay, so obviously this is one of the main issues that we see in history, that people comparing themselves to the Lord, trying to become God themselves, essentially. Okay, but how can one do that? I mean, I think the other day, was it Taruna Prabhu or someone was talking about the creation and Mahavishnu and how every universe is coming out of his pores every time he breathes out and every time he breathes in, the universe is coming in. Like, how do you compare to that? How can you possibly try and compete with that? It's just like ridiculous, like bubbles. They're just coming out like bubbles, So again, one of the main thing that Prabhupada's saying again and again is that we have to try and avoid doing this. And we see throughout history, people, civilizations trying to become like God. When civilizations, they do a bit of tapasya, then they become powerful. And generally they do their tapasya to God because they're going through like, for example, you get a civilization going through lots of wars, famine, all that kind of stuff. And then they're very God-fearing. Oh Lord, please save us. Please save us from the wrath of the elements and from the invaders and all that kind of stuff. And then through that, because they're doing some tapasya, they start to gradually, over the generations, get benedictions. The brain power starts to increase, right? They start to become like very materially comfortable. And then what happens? They start to take God out of the picture, right? And then, of course, what happens? Purna mushtika bhav, right? Then again, because they've come away, they're going to descend back into ignorance again, and their whole civilization will collapse again and again. We see this throughout history, right? Right now, of course, we're in Western civilization. It's a classic case. Western civilization at one point, medieval times, was very, very Christian, very, very God-fearing. Now, of course, it's kind of like trying to take God out of the picture. It's all about artificial intelligence. No, it's about this aspect and that aspect. But then you'll find that as time goes by, if it's not careful, then it's going to start to descend into barbarity as well. Okay? And of course, this something is that we see on an individual level as well. There's a famous case of the person, some of you are going to probably smile at this, in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time, there was a famous personality called Bhishakshena, right? He was also, he did a bit of tapasya, and then he thought that he's God. He thought he's Mahavishnu, right? But then it's not even like and obviously the other such men as well who are actively trying to play God. But even in modern times, for example, we mentioned how there are these multi-billionaire kind of like, powerful industrialists that even though, obviously with people like Bhishakshena or these kind of so-called godmen, they are actively trying to be God. But there are also people now who are unknowingly also trying to be God, right, just through their actions, right, because they're so confident in their own abilities. Like we mentioned how these two big industrious, Elon Musk, Richard Branson, who had a race to try and get to the moon, to the planets, right? It kind of reminded me of, like, you know, Ravana? There's a case of Ravana trying to build the stairs to the heavenly regions, right? But obviously realized it just wasn't happening. And then they're having a race between themselves or trying to get to the moon. And of course, Elon Musk, and interesting enough, he was also talking about before, by the, for those of you who don't know, he's the CEO of Tesla, Tesla Enterprises. And he was talking, I think that cause has kind of died down now, where he's talking about trying to colonize Mars. And he said that first thing to do is we need to actually nuke Mars first. So he had a whole campaign called Nuke Mars, right? Like nuclearly attack Mars, right? To try and like trigger off some living environment, right? So it's unknowingly trying to play God, thinking that you have the power, you have the right to actually nuke another planet as if it's your property, right? So we have to be careful, of course, even within spirituality. The desire to be God can manifest if we are not sticking on the straight and narrow. So thank God that we have a parampara system and that scriptures are in the line of parampara. Because otherwise, you know, history can show us that if we're not careful, especially when we advance in our spiritual life, especially when the perks of the bhakti otta come through, right? The puja, love, and pratishta, and all these things, then if we're not actually, you know, very much in line with the parampara, we can start to think, you know, that, you know, we are the man. Okay? So, yeah, because actually a lot of religious movements have actually fallen away because they end up having a God complex personality. So the parampara, this is very good. I remember Kripamoy Puru once saying that Prabhupada's purports actually save us because they make us understand actually what's going on. You know, more than actually even the slokas themselves, because the purports is what makes us understand the slokas and keeps us in line. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in Canto 10, Chapter 66, there's also the famous case of the personality who tried to be Krishna. Does anyone know who I'm talking about? That's right, Pondarik. Pondarik was the king of... Well, actually, they give different names for it. In one part, they call it Karusa, the kingdom of Karusa. Otherwise, known as Kashi. I think a lot of us have heard of the Kashi kingdom, which is now modern-day Varanasi, right? Yeah, Varanasi, right? And so, foolish person. Prabhupada said he's a foolish person because he's being told by his associates that he's Krishna. So Prabhupada goes, and then the Vishnachakri Thakur gives a commentary on this, and he says this is a classic case of cheaters and the cheated, right? Because this is a very key indication that you must be careful what kind of association you keep. There's a famous saying, right? A man is judged by the company he keepeth. Right, so we have to obviously be careful what kind of company we keep. Ravana as well. There was that one time actually, Ravana even had second thoughts about the whole, you know, Ram Sita, whether to keep Sita or not. At one point, he was actually, you know, thinking because Vibhishan was trying to influence him, saying, "Look, give this up, stop this nonsense." And Ravana at one point was even thinking, maybe he's got a point, you know. And then at that point, what happens? His associates goes, "No, stick with the plan. You're doing good. You can destroy Ravana. You can destroy Ram. Not a problem." Right? Foolish associates, cheaters and the cheated. So Prabhupada and Vishnachakri Thakur both say that. And then, of course, Pondarik then starts to threaten Krishna, saying that I am the king. I'm the real Krishna. I'm the one with the paraphernalia. It's interesting. Vishnachakri Thakur mentions that whatever Pondarik was saying, Jai Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda ki, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ji ki, Sri Sri Gaur Nitai ki, Jai. Yeah. So it said that it's interesting that whatever Pondarik was saying, his curses to Krishna, actually it's Krishna's wordplay that actually those same phrases that Pondarik was saying to Krishna are actually indirectly indicating that Krishna is the actually supreme and I'm the fake one, even though he didn't realize it himself. Right? So whether it's Krishna doing that or whether you got Saraswati to do that to land on Pondarik's tongue and get him to speak in such a way, it's interesting to see. And so Prabhupada says that posing as God is the greatest, trying to pose as God is basically you're like the greatest fool in human society. Anyway, sooner or later, Pondarik did get destroyed by Krishna. Krishna said that no one can obviously replace God, no one can take the place of God. And then, of course, Pondrik's son, Sudakshina, he also got very, very angry at the fact that his father got destroyed by Krishna. So then he actually prayed to Lord Shiva to give him a weapon by which he can destroy Krishna. Lord Shiva goes, I will give you a person, I will give you a weapon which you'll direct against those people unfavorable to Brahmanas. So what Sudakshina did was that he got lots of Brahmanas to do the yajnas to help him in invoking Lord Shiva. So he's thinking, okay, unfavorable to Brahmanas, Brahmanas are on my side, no problem, give me that weapon. So then Lord Shiva delivered him a fearsome fiery demon. And so then what happens that this fierce, and then Pondrik's son, Sudakshina, because Pondrik's dead now, right? Sudakshina sent this fiery demon to Dwarka. Go and destroy Dwarka, Krishna, his whole kingdom, right? But then what happens? It said here that when that demon went there, he realized that Shiva's also very clever. He said that I will give you a weapon which you can direct against people who are unfavorable to Brahmanas. Now, is Krishna unfavorable to Brahmanas? No, actually he's the protector of the Brahmanas. So obviously Sudakshina didn't realize that. So what happened? That demon went back from Dwarka, came back to Kasi. It says that when you release a weapon, if it doesn't go to its appropriate target, it's going to come back on you, right? And then what happened? It burnt down the whole of Kasi and Sudakshina, the whole dynasty. So Prabhupada said that when demons try to create something to kill God, instead what happens? The demons themselves are killed. So we must always be careful that we always keep on the straight and narrow. We have that humility. That's one of the main qualities of devotion. That we do not get caught up in the hype. Especially as devotees, when we encounter the perks, like I said, a bhakti yota, or even before that, when one is doing unsteady bhajana kriya and encounters the perk of taranga rangini, where we get a lot of skills, following, all these kind of things. The main thing is don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Okay? There was one governor of Rome back in the day, and he had one person, assistant, next to him. And his job was simply, when he's giving these large lectures to large Senate members, you know, the crowd, you know, imagine you're a Roman governor, you can imagine that people are going to be like, you know, just completely putting on a pedestal. And his job was simply to whisper in this governor's ear, I'll find the name of this governor, actually. He just whispered in his ear, remember, you are just a man. Remember, you are just a man. Every so often, every few hours, he would just come in. I'm sure he had other services to do apart from that, obviously. But one of his services, literally just to come in and whisper in the governor's ear, or the emperor's ear, sorry. Remember, you are just a man. Just to keep him humble. So that's, of course, we have devotees around us. They also keep us humble as well. So, okay. So that's the kind of inconceivability of Krishna, as well as the understanding that he's the father of everything. We should not try to imitate him. The next aspect, and this is definitely where, you know, I think this is where we need to work together, right? Where we need to look at is where Prabhupada says here that, the Lord is the father of all living beings who are countless in number. Therefore, only a few of them are called to associate with the Lord. Okay. Only a few of them are called to associate with the Lord in his pastimes. Okay? So one of the issues that was brought up by this is, like for example here as well, Prabhupada even says that Yudhishthira Maharaj, he mentions some of the chieftain sons, like Sushena, Chabudeshna, Samba, Rishabha. But it says that it was impossible for him to remember all the names of the Lord's family members. Okay, so for example, what does that mean? Like, obviously, we know that, especially as well, later on in the Bhagavatam, we see so many names of different kings coming up. And we're told in classes, because people often ask, why are there so many names? Why are these names there in the Bhagavatam? What's the use for us? But the understanding is glorification of these devotees. The fact that their names got into the Bhagavatam means that, and somehow, they were special in one sense. So I guess the question is, what is the qualification for a person's name to come into the Bhagavatam or a scripture? Like these few chieftains got into the Bhagavatam, but not all of them did, right? So what is the qualification, and how does one group devotees according to these qualities? And that, of course, goes on to the other aspect, is how does one group devotees? Okay, who defines, like, you know, this group is like this and this group is like that? So any thoughts on this? What qualifies a person to get into the Bhagavatam? How comes that only these chieftain sons got in there, but not all the chieftains did? Any thoughts on that? Yes, Munina?
I'm just assuming that the individuals whose names are given, probably as one looks into the pastimes more deeper, set an example for us to be able to follow in one way or another. Just like in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's in the fourth chapter, where Krishna says that we're learning from these particular sages. These sages who follow this mood of renunciation and devotional service are the ones that you should follow in their footsteps. So probably their names pop up, you know, to for us to be able to get something as we dive deeper and understand, different qualities and things that we need to know.
Okay, thank you for that. I mean, I guess one could argue that, but then a lot of these names, we don't know about them, except that they're just names in the Bhagavatam. Like, how do we know about their qualities? It's a difficult one. Maybe Antaranga probably can shed some more light on this.
I heard one of the opinions of devotees that you can actually track the gotras of these personalities, and you can actually establish the factual that Bhagavatam is a historical event rather than some mythology. So some of those names you can still kind of see that there are some lineages coming from these personalities. So there's a specific section, I don't know where it is, in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam.
It is fifth canto.
Just names and names and names. One of the purport Prabhupada mentions is this is showing that these personalities have been present, they've been real, and there are still lineages coming from them.
Thank you very much. Actually, that's the note I had noted down as well, that it gives a sense of history and it gives a sense of authenticity. When you've got names there, it gives it tangible. Also, similarly, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you know, you've got these verse after verse where Prabhupada talks about the directions of like a certain places. That if you turn left here and go past this station, and then, you know, then go like two doors left, then you'll see this place. It's like, and you're like reading it thinking, okay, what, how do I make sense of it? Again, it's there to give a sense of history. This is not mythology. This is real history. This is our heritage. So therefore, it's good that they give these names. They give some validity to it as well. Thank you very much for that. Yes, Sutapa Prabhu?
Just also that Shastra should be understood in an integrative way. So each Shastra doesn't stand alone. So it might seem like, what's the point of just having this name in this Shastra and nothing said about it? But then what it helps you to do is cross-reference with another Shastra, and in that way you can verify things and find out more about personalities and traditions and lines and different things like that. So because Shastra is understood as a whole, it allows to cross-reference.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much. It's cross-referencing, because it's not just one book, it's a whole body of books, isn't it? That's giving us like a whole world that we're trying to access here. So thank you very much for that. And often it's like here as well, that it's giving example of a few of the main personalities here. So often what happens is, you know, there are wonderful, wonderful devotees, highly advanced devotees. They're not all, unless they necessarily mention in the Shastra. But in a lot of cases, it could be like the prototypes of that field in which that devotee is prominent are given. Right? What I mean by that is, for example, again, me and Sutapapa were talking about this. The Panchatattva. Why is the Panchatattva the Panchatattva? Right? Why is it those specific five personalities are the Panchatattva? Well, because they are the embodiment of what they're representing. Right? I mean, okay, they were non-different from Krishna, that's true. But the embodiment. So, you know, we have the famous Panchatattva prayer. Panchatattva makam krishnam bhakti ruka sarupakam bhaktavataram bhaktyakam namami bhakti shaktikam. Right? So basically, of this, you have the Supreme Lord Krishna, non-different from his features as a devotee, who is Mahaprabhu. Then, of course, you've got the devotional manifestation, which is obviously Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the embodiment of that. Lord Nityananda is a devotional incarnation. Advaita Acharya, he's the, devotional incarnation. Then, of course, you've got the devotional energy, which is Gadadhar Pandit, right? Because, you know, he's rather running. And, of course, you've got the embodiment of the pure devotee, Srivas Pandit. So that's not to say that there are other not the other pure devotees there. It's not that there are not other devotional manifestations, but they are the prototype, if you will, the epitome of what they're representing, okay? Similarly, one question has raised that, what about the six Goswamis of Vrindavan? Because obviously, apart from the six Goswamis, there are other Goswamis like Lokanath Goswami, Bhugarbha Goswami. They were also super pure devotees. Sorry, I was going to say super devotees, right? They were pure devotees as well. But why are they specifically the six? Because they were the ones who epitomized the specific roles that they were tasked with. Mahaprabhu specifically chose them to be the ones to uncover the sevasthans, to establish the literature. It's not that other devotees don't do that, but they were the ones who are basically the epitome of that, right? Just like, for example, in a brahmachari ashram, you might get 20-odd brahmacharis, but it's the brahmachari leader who's kind of representing the ashram. So it's not that the other brahmacharis are not brahmacharis, they're also brahmacharis, but the brahmachari leader is the one who's representing, right? Shaunak Rishi was the one who's representing the sages, right? So it's almost like the epitomes are there, and they're the ones that are basically grouped in that way. And obviously, even if you look at groups, there are so many different groupings of devotees, isn't there? Like, for example, you have groups in terms of advancement, neophyte, Kanishta, Kanishta is neophyte, Madhyama Adhikari, Uttama Adhikari. You have even groups in terms of what constitutes a devotee. I can't remember, Antaranga Prabhu might know this. You know, the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he mentions that a devotee is someone who chants the holy names of the Lord. Whereas Balidev Vidyabhushan says a devotee is someone who's chanting specifically Sudhanam. So what is it then? Is a devotee just someone who chants the holy name of the Lord? Or is it someone who's only chanting Sudhanam? What even constitutes a devotee? How does one group these categories? Well, actually, I've got something here. This is from Gaudiya Kantahar. It's a collection of verses by Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. So he says here, that actually Mahaprabhu answers this, because you know this is a question that often comes up. What makes a devotee? Even in ISKCON we might define that, isn't it? What makes a devotee? Right? So Mahaprabhu says this in the Madhya Lila. Prabhu kahe yara mukhe suni ekabar, Krishna naam se puja shreshta sabakar. The Lord said, whoever chants the holy name of Krishna just once may be considered a Vaishnav. Such a person is worshipable and the topmost human being. So that means just chanting once makes you a Vaishnav. Okay. But then Mahaprabhu goes on. He goes, Krishna naam nirantara yahara vadane, shei Vaishnav shrishta bhaja tahara charane. A person who's always chanting the holy name of the Lord is superior Vaishnav, and your duty to serve his lotus feet. Okay, so that's going a bit deeper. And then Mahaprabhu then goes on further. Yahara darshane mukhe eshe Krishna naam, tahare janiha tumi Vaishnav pradhan. The topmost Vaishnav is he whose very presence makes others chant the holy name of Krishna. He is superior to all others. So they're all Vaishnavs. One's an ordinary Vaishnav, one's a superior Vaishnav, and one's a topmost Vaishnav. Okay? One thing we also have to be careful of is when we're looking at different groupings of devotees, for our side, you know, we should be careful in, are we going to put them into a hierarchy for our side? For example, it's said in the Bhagavatam that Prahlad is the best of the devotees, right? But then it goes on to say, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj says in Laghu Bhagavatamrita, it says, better than Prahlad are the Pandavas, okay? Better than because Pandavas spent more quality time with Krishna. But then in the Laghu Bhagavatamrita, it goes on to say the Yadavas are superior to the Pandavas, right? Because Krishna was born in the Yadu dynasty. And then it says on top of that, Uddhava is superior to the Yadavas. Who do you think is superior then to Uddhava? You can see here, something's going on here, right? Huh? Very good, the gopis, right? Again, this is from Bhagavatam, the gopis. And then this is interesting. It says here the gopis are superior to Uddhava. And then who is the best of all the gopis? Radharani. Radharani. And then at the same time, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says, Gauranga's devotees are also the topmost. Because it says, those who perform the duties of Varnashram Dharma worship Lord Vishnu, visit many holy places, neglect the service of the lotus feet of the great devotees who are dear to Lord Chaitanya, and never able to understand the pastimes of Radha Govinda in the confidential abode of Vrindavan. Now it's interesting though, so if Gauranga's devotees are the topmost, but when you go to Gauranga's devotee and surrender at the lotus feet, they're going to then bring you to the lotus feet of Prahlad, and the Pandavas, and the Yadus, and then the Gopis. So it's almost like a circle, isn't it? It's like a circle of like never-ending like devotion, and like, you know, then for us it's like figuring out, okay, is someone higher, someone's lower? I think for us, from our case, it's best to just, you know, appreciate them all for who they are. Yeah, is there any thoughts, any comments on this? Because, you know, we're looking at grouping devotees according to different things, but that means if a person's outside of the group, does that mean that we relegate them? No. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said that actually devotees are not concerned about their fame. Actually, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is very heavy on this. I'll finish here because I know we're running out of time now. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said that devotees looking for fame, it's as worth, this is from the Mahajanir Gita, right? It's a scripture. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is saying that devotees looking for fame are no different from like the stool of a hog, right? It's worthless. And it goes that the people who do pseudo bhajans to get some fame, you know, they're like dog-eating prostitutes, things like that. Heavy, heavy statements. So the point that we have to understand from this, that we as Vaishnavas are not looking for fame. We're not looking for like being in the books so that people remember our names in history. If it happens, it happens. Ultimately, it's Krishna's sweet will who he puts in the books. But we nonetheless appreciate those devotees who are mentioned here, as well as those who are not mentioned as well. Okay? Okay, there was one other point I was going to talk about Yudhishthir not remembering the names, but I think time's gone now. So I'll finish here. Any thoughts, questions, comments? Yes, I'll start with Kishori and then Antaranga Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for the class. It was just a reflection. I recently had an experience where there was one lady who I was trying to cultivate, and she was very new to Krishna consciousness, and she got given the Srimad Bhagavatam that she was reading. And in her area, there was no devotee. She had no association. There was no sangha. And anyway, so she recently read something in the Bhagavatam that she couldn't understand, and it was quite strong, and it put her off Krishna consciousness, and now she's gone to Christianity. And, you know, I tried to speak with her over the phone and this and that, but nothing kind of worked, because what she read in the Bhagavatam was so disturbing to her in relation to her own understanding. So I'm just wondering, like, when we're encouraged to distribute Bhagavatams, you know, like some we do door to door and distribute sets even sometimes, and even Chaitanya Charitamrita. And I'm just wondering, like, how should we view that? Because without the association of devotees, I know Srila Prabhupada's purports are there, definitely, but without the association to discuss these matters, it can be really difficult, even for like devotees to understand, let alone someone who's very, very new. So I'm just wondering if you have any advice or, yeah, like guidance on that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's something actually a lot of us have thought about as well. Well, they say that when you study scriptures, it should be done in the association of devotees, actually. Because if you're trying to study it separately, it gets very difficult. I think when you're giving out, you know, like more simpler books, like Chant and Be Happy, or, you know, even Science of Self-Realization, actually, those books are okay for people to kind of study on them, because what Prabhupada is doing, he's giving the basics in a very kind of modern, contemporary way. But yeah, when it comes to like actual deep scriptures, like Bhagavatam and things like that, there should be some guidance for those people. So that when you sign them up, even if you're going to, like, let's say, doing sets or giving to, there should be like some sort of, sign them up to some sort of correspondence right? So that, okay, you got the Bhagavatam now. Now let's get you on like our festival program where you come, or on some sort of like mentorship guidance thing where, you know, we can have some correspondence. We have like book reading clubs or something, and, you know, whatever you're reading, we can then get together every 2 weeks and then discuss what's being discussed, discuss what's being read, you know, all like that. I think there should be some sort of extra thing. Just like Antaranga Prabhu, you know, he's instituted this thing in the Sangitan where when he distributes books, he then signs them up and then follows up with them. Follow up, that's the word I'm looking for. There has to be follow up. Yeah, because otherwise, yeah, it gets difficult, you know. If you leave it with people of their own mindset, then they can easily take it their own way. So my personal view, with these kind of books, there should be some follow up, not just you give it to them, that's it, Hari Bol. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. Antaranga?
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Niskanchana, for the class. Very nice. Very encouraging. Just one point regarding the grouping of devotees. Prabhupada many times said, actually, our movement is based on discrimination. But obviously, the moment we, especially in these days, when we say this term, it has very negative connotation. So discrimination means that we understand our level of others, and based on that, we associate with them. So in terms of grouping devotees, I think is important, but also that person has to have that vision to understand what is the platform of on which we are grouping those people. So that was just, you know, just one.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I mean, there has to be discrimination. Well, I guess the key what I was trying to convey is that we can appreciate where people are, and then we know how to associate with them accordingly. At the same time, we're not there to obviously, you know, form opinions of their worth, like, you know, like judging them in the sense of, oh, you're bad and, you know, you're low and you're high. Because even let's say you got people who are not part of the six Goswamis, they still, we can get so much from them. Like Bhugarbha Goswami, Lokanath Goswami, it's like, you know, Lokanath Goswami is like the spiritual master of, was it Narottam Das Thakur, right? You know, it's like, okay, he's not part of the six Goswamis. Are we going to say, oh, he's not part of the six Goswamis? No, he's also an amazing devotee. So groups are there for particular purposes. We appreciate them. And yes, there is also a hierarchy as well, to some level. Okay, last comment from Munine.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the class. It was really, really nice. I really enjoyed that. Just in connection to the question that Kishori Mataji was asking, there's this book that's being compiled of, like, quotes. It's been done by His Holiness Bhaktivikash Maharaj, and he compiles different quotes by Prabhupada, and he kind of ties it into this point where basically Prabhupada is saying, you know, what's the use of trying to get thousands of people, but if you can get that one person who's actually going to take it seriously, then that's the most glorious thing, you know? And he was connecting it to the fact that, you know, many people might take these books and read, and I find a lot of things that they say puts them off and criticize it, and they criticize it, or they can't stomach it. But ideally, we're looking for those ones who actually will take shelter of this knowledge as it's in its absolute position. So, because it also reminds me of a question she asked His Holiness Devamrita Maharaj of, how do you know when is the point, you know, you should reach with someone when you're trying, and it doesn't work, and you just realize. And Maharaj gave the response of, you know, it takes practice. But yeah, there was that sense of, you know, if they are conflicting with the knowledge that's given, and that's why Prabhupada still, you know, said distribute all the Bhagavatams, CC was going out and everything, because you still cultivate those ones who are actually ready to take shelter of it. Otherwise, and you can filter them out, the ones who want to take it seriously and the ones who just leave because of something they can't stomach.
Yes. When Prabhupada's giving those books out, emergency situation, he needed the core devotee people to come through, right? As we progress, though, we also want to reach out to the masses, intelligent classes as well as the mass people, right? So then we also need to try and convey for them, just like, for example, we've got ordinary Vaishnavas just chanting the Hare Krishna, superior Vaishnavas, topmost Vaishnavas. You know that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave a category. So we also need to give the knowledge in a way. Because remember, we want Brahmanas, Vaishyas, Kshatriyas, and Sudras. 90% of any given society are going to be Sudras. So that means most devotees will, and, you know, be that. It will be the core Brahmanas will be like the ones deep into the scriptures, but we need to also give the knowledge in a way that the Sudras can also understand as well. So that's why it's good that, you know, Prabhupada said, write. He told his disciples to write, because then when we write, we can then give the knowledge in a way accessible to our time for people to understand.
Yeah, Prabhupada, just one more quick point. I know we've got to go. But it's a very interesting point you've raised there. But we have to bear in mind also, we should maybe think that people aren't ready sometimes for Krishna consciousness. And so one might go to Christianity because by God's grace, that's where they belong at that time in their life. You know, that's where they're at. So God will meet them at that point. So we're not going to maybe successful in cultivating everyone that we meet. Even they might show some initial interest. They might turn away because they're not ready for it. It's not their time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good point as well. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for staying over. I think the prasadam is waiting for us. So, Granthraj Srimad Bhagatam ki.